worldwide news update.
Today is a day of mourning in Israel. It's a very sad day for all of us.
The bodies presumed to be of the youngest Israelis held hostage by Hamas have been returned to Israel on Thursday. According to Hamas, Shirley Bibas and her two sons, Ariel and Kefir, who were 4 years old and 9 months old when they were abducted from Kibbutz Nir Oz, were killed by an Israeli airstrike in the first few weeks of the war. Yarden Bibas, the father, was released on February 1st. Arik Diamant is a Tel Aviv resident.
We're very sad that it's come to this, that we're returning bodies and not really rejoicing, but feeling some relief at the return of the bodies of these kidnapped people, children and infants.
The fourth body returned was that of Oded Lifshitz, a journalist who campaigned for the recognition of Palestinian rights and peace between Arab and Jews. The bodies released Thursday will be formally identified, which could take up to 48 hours. A significant rift has opened between the U.S. and Ukraine after President Donald Trump blamed Kyiv for the war in Russia. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
President Trump blasted Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky,
a dictator without elections,
at a business conference in Miami, saying
the only thing he was really good at was playing Joe Biden like a fiddle. He played him like a fiddle.
The leaders of Germany and the UK, among those jumping to Zelensky's defense, Prime Minister Keir Starmer noting Britain suspended elections during World War II, and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz calling it wrong and dangerous to deny Zelensky's democratic legitimacy. But with the U.S. and Russia agreeing to negotiate an end to the war, Trump warned
Zelensky better move fast or he's not going to have a country left.
Ukraine says the terms U.S. officials have discussed are too favorable to Moscow. Ben Thomas, Washington.
This is VOA News. South Korea's suspended President Yoon Suk-yeol attended the 10th hearing of his impeachment trial on Thursday. Yoon appeared in two different courts, contesting his arrest on rebellion charges in one and pleading to preserve his presidency in the other, both related to his brief imposition of martial law in December. The court was also reviewing a request by Yoon's lawyers to cancel his arrest and release him. South Korea's constitutional court said on Thursday that the next hearing in a trial on whether to oust impeach President Yoon Suk-yeol or restore his presidential power will be February 25th. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov arrived in South Africa for the two-day meeting of the group of 20 nations where top European diplomats are expected to reinforce their support for Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is boycotting the meeting and has pledged to also skip the main G20 summit in South Africa in November. The boycott is amid tensions with South Africa over some of its policies that the Trump administration has condemned as anti-American. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent also said he will not attend a G20 finance ministers meeting in South Africa next week. While South Africa hopes that the meeting will make progress on issues affecting the developing world like debt refinancing and climate change, one of the first sessions will involve discussions on the global geopolitical situation, according to the agenda. Pope Francis is continuing his recovery from double pneumonia. AP correspondent Naeon Kim has more.
In a statement, the Vatican confirmed that new blood tests showed a slight improvement and that the pontiff is now eating breakfast out of bed after a 6th peaceful night at the hospital. Francis was admitted to Rome's Gemelli Hospital on February 14 after a bout of bronchitis worsened. Doctors on Tuesday diagnosed him with pneumonia in both lungs. Prayers are growing for the 88-year-old pontiff. Outside the hospital where he's being treated, flowers and candles are being laid. Rome's diocese invited all parishes and religious communities of the city to hold a silent prayer for the health of Pope Francis. I'm Naeon Kim.
Speaking at the Halifax International Security Forum in Taipei, Secretary General of National Security Council of Taiwan, Joseph Wu, is confident the U.S. will continue its support of the island.
Our support in the Congress, our support from those people who were already nominated or who will be nominated and serve in the administration will still be there. So I think the Trump administration's support for Taiwan will remain very strong.
That said, Taiwan is looking to head off President Donald Trump's threats of hefty tariffs on its semiconductor chips. Trump has previously accused Taiwan of stealing the U.S. chip industry and suggested it should pay the United States for its defense. Taiwan lives under the constant threat of an invasion by China, which claims the island as part of its territory. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Christina Menenti, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight, on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News tonight.
What we can see is a correlation between climate change and, countries facing more and more shocks like flooding, like drought, and the increased number of public health emergencies in the different countries.
That was UNICEF child protection expert Yanine Grandin on several African countries facing disease outbreaks. Details coming up also. Some analysts say Russian disinformation campaigns have been key factors in French troops departing Africa's Sahel region. And a high-ranking UN official says Libya's unity and stability continue to suffer erosion. These stories and more on Africa News tonight. But first, our top story. UNICEF is warning of multiple disease outbreaks across large parts of Africa. UNICEF child protection specialist Yanine Grandin in Nairobi tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that this year, 17 out of 21 countries in Eastern and Southern Africa are grappling with public health emergencies, including outbreaks of cholera, mpox, and viral hemorrhagic fever, which threaten the safety of children.
During that press release, we are covering what we call the Eastern and Southern Africa that span from South Sudan to South Africa, and that covers 21 countries, 17 countries out of the 21 countries that UNICEF Regional Office are covering where dealing with a public health emergency.
What factors are contributing to this high number of public health emergencies and these disease outbreaks right now?
What we can see is a correlation between climate change and, countries facing more and more shocks like flooding, like drought, and the increased number of public health emergencies in the different countries, yes.
The alarming frequency of public health emergencies and disease outbreaks in the regions is disrupting vital safety nets for children, according to your regional director for Eastern and Southern Africa, Etliba Kadili. What types of safety nets for children are we talking about?
I think we are referring to three main category of safety nets. Of course, the family, that is taking care of the child, and when the public health emergency is declared and the family or someone in the family is affected, that has a direct impact on the children. We're also talking about the community, and some specific outbreaks, what is creating the social network, the social fabric might be impacted, but also overall the services. And we've seen that, since even COVID was probably the most obvious one, but when school are closing, then children are, left alone, and they are more exposed to different risk and factor of the protection safety net, yeah.
When you talk about cholera, mpox, these are life-threatening, right? Have children been dying from these disease outbreaks in Africa?
Yes, of course. The children are either directly impacted, they can die of it, or they are indirectly impacted because someone in their family is sick.
Tell me about hemorrhagic fevers. You said that this is there's been a recent uptick in that. What are the symptoms?
Depending on the outbreak, you can have a parents, family member that are put into isolation center, while in other they would, the family could have some access to them.
I understand that the hemorrhagic fevers, including Marburg virus, is happening in Tanzania, and Ebola disease is becoming a threat too. Where is that happening?
As far as I know, we've got Ebola outbreak in Uganda, and Marburg is in Tanzania. I mean, the number of cases for Ebola is still limited. And, the government and the defense stakeholders are trying to contain what is happening in those countries.
What is UNICEF wanting to see happen to address these health emergencies in Africa?
I think UNICEF is working with the government to strengthen the medical system, just to make sure that, it's more shock responsive, knowing that the public health emergency are more frequent, so that the system, the health system, is better prepared. But I think one of the considerations that UNICEF is having is to look at the different dimensions that a public health emergency can have, not only on the health aspect, but also on the protection, on the education outcome for children, also on the social fabric that can be affected by those emergency.
That was UNICEF Child Protection Specialist Jan Grandin. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Nairobi, Kenya. The 2024 Corruption Perceptions Index, CPI, underscores that corruption remains a critical issue worldwide. Sub-Saharan Africa again scored the lowest average at 33 out of 100, with 90% of the region's countries scoring below 50. However, some nations have made remarkable progress through anti-corruption efforts. The highest scores include Seychelles, 72, Cabo Verde, 62, Botswana and Rwanda, 57. The lowest scores are Equatorial Guinea, 13, Eritrea, 13, Somalia, 9, and South Sudan, 8. VOA's Paul Ndiho spoke with Sombo Muzata, director of the MPA program and assistant professor at James Madison University, about the report's significance.
We've seen over the years that a number of countries continue to score below 50 points, and the global average of 43 has remained persistently for a very long time. When we think about the African continent, only three countries scored above 50. That should be Mauritius, Botswana, and I think Rwanda. Those are the only three countries that scored above 50. So in a way, we are making good progress. But if only three countries out of 54 or 55 countries are scoring above 50, then you know that there's a problem.
We keep talking about serious issues of corruption when it comes to Africa. You look at the scoreboard, Africa continues to score very, very low. Yeah. What should Africans do, or what should anti-corruption agencies in most African countries do to fight this plague?
We are talking about perceptions. Perceptions are perception.
There are people who say perception is reality.
If perception is reality, can you tell me the exact monetary values? The Corruption Perceptions Index is a very good measure to get us to think about corruption and to get us to think about the magnitude of the problem. But we need to keep in mind that these are perceptions that we're looking at. We don't have actual monetary values of how much money has been lost to corruption in each of the countries. Okay, so it's individuals' perceptions, and perceptions are determined by a lot of things. There is also bias when you talk about perceptions. If you have a score of 100, it means that you're doing very well. Well, any score in that higher range means you're doing well. If you have lower scores, it means that you're not doing so well. So most countries in Africa score around 10, 15, 20s and the 30s, you know, 40s and thereabouts, but below 50, we have the magnitude of the countries.
You talked about biases earlier. A lot of people, when they look at Africa, especially some African countries, they automatically say that because of ABCD things happening in that country, it must be a corrupt country. So how can Africans, who in most cases are not interviewed, buy into this report?
My goal here is not to discredit the integrity of the methodology that they use. So I know that they do a lot of work in aggregating the data from the different sources. But then the question that you raise is very important. Who is being interviewed? And I think that's a very, very important question that we need to answer. Whose perceptions are we looking at?
You just had a very, very successful anti-corruption conference at your university. Maybe break it down. What do you guys talk about?
The Accountability in African Public Policy and Administration Conference. This was the third time we were hosting it. We did the first one at the University of Pretoria 2023, and last year it was at James Madison University in Washington, D.C., and this year we're here in Harrisonburg. So we covered a range of topics. We're basically looking at accountability within the space of land and land administration, and this was drawn from the larger AAAD theme for the conference, which was land and freedom. So as you might know, land is a very contentious contentious issue, especially in this day and age. So we had a very comprehensive conversation covering practitioners, covering people close to policymakers, diplomats in this case, and then also academics. So the real focus really going on forward with this conversation is to see how we can enhance scholarship on accountability, we can enhance scholarship on anti-corruption initiatives in Africa, and learn and share best practices.
That was Dr. Sambo Muzata, director of the MPA program and assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at James Madison University. He spoke with VOA's Bolandiho. Some Africa analysts say Russian propaganda and disinformation campaigns have been key factors behind the departure of French troops from Chad and other countries in Africa's Sahel region. In this report from N'Djamena, Chad, Henry Wilkins takes a closer look at Russia's media strategies in the Sahel as French troops depart.
Chad's military, seen here in late January, is marking the departure of French troops from the country after more than 60 years. At the ceremony, Chadian President Mohamed Idriss Déby said the departure was a new dawn for a fully sovereign Chad. But analysts say a Russian propaganda campaign in the region played a key role in the French troops' departure. Bakary Sambe is with the Timbuktu Institute.
Russia is leveraging this colonial history and anti-imperialist sentiment to fuel resentment among young Africans, public opinion, and even influencers against French interests and France's presence in the Sahel.
Chad is the latest of four countries in the Sahel, alongside Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, to have asked French troops to leave over the last 2 years. All have, at the same time, welcomed in Russian troops. Experts like Sambe say Russia uses a network of fake social media accounts to amplify anti-French narratives and spread conspiracy theories. Russia has also set up cultural institutes across the Sahel in the last 2 years.
For decades, Western countries have opened cultural institutes in African capitals to share their culture, to spread their language, and ultimately their soft power.
But unlike other cultural institutes, investigative reporters say the Russian houses also train journalists who then go on to spread propaganda. Russia's embassy in Chad and the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs did not respond to requests for comment. But why is Russia so focused on the Sahel? Constantin Guvi is with the Klingendael Institute in the Netherlands.
So through the disinformation campaigns, Russia's goal has been mostly to sow chaos in the region. And so Russia wants to come in and essentially replace states like France as the new primary partner for these salient states.
Sambe says,
c'est-à-dire que la démarche de la Russie, c'est justement pour dire aux Occidentaux et aux
Russia's approach is to send a message to the West, particularly NATO countries like France, saying, if you create geopolitical problems for us in the Donbass or in Europe, we will retaliate in your sphere of influence, the Sahel. This essentially transposes the conflict onto Sahelian territory.
On the streets of N'Djamena, it's clear the public believes French troops leaving Chad is a positive step for the country.
We know that France does not come with any benefit to us, so it's not necessary for them to stay in our country. They should leave.
Since France's troops began leaving the Sahel in 2022, fatalities due to conflict in the region, mostly from clashes between state armies and jihadists, have gone up by 65%, according to data from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, N'Djamena.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. will be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News tonight. VOA's Anthony Labruto is covering the annual CPAC conference in Washington, D.C. today. We have him live by phone. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning, Ed.
So what is CPAC and what is the significance of this year's conference?
So CPAC is a short form for the Conservative Political Action Conference. And so that's an annual gathering of conservatives, primarily from the United States, but really in the past couple of years, it's since grown to include other countries from around the world. So most notably, we have the United Kingdom, Australia, and also Korea all have strong delegations here, all also have strong conservative politicians here. So especially this year, this conference is really seen as one attendee I spoke to put it, a victory lap. So the Republican Party, which is the dominant conservative identifying party in the U.S., has won both a majority in Congress and the presidency, we know from Donald Trump. And so it really is seen by attendees as the celebration of ideas that brought their elected officials to the majority power in Washington, D.C. And so, and also as a radio commentator put it out there, as we're just off media row right here, there really has been no CPAC like a Trump CPAC.
So Vice President J.D. Vance opened the conference. What did he focus on the speech?
So his speech really focused on delivering those campaign promises. He spent the first probably about 25 minutes describing, you know, it's now been 30 days into the new Trump administration, really showcasing and giving attendees a look into kind of his personal efforts to really deliver on a variety of topics that affect them. So energy policy, border security, government efficiency with Joe really got a standing ovation with the crowd here. And so he asked, what are we doing with the American taxpayer money and what are we spending it on? He gave a variety of statistics, a variety of things that DOGE has already gone through and found so far. The speech also focused on his recent trip to the Munich Security Conference, really one of his first breakout events as vice president, where he struck a different tone than the previous Biden administration. Vance cited illegal immigration as one of the top shared issues affecting both the United States and Europe. He called for greater free speech protections for both the U.S. and European countries. And European conservative leaders, too, as I mentioned, in the United Kingdom, that were attending CPAC, Vance welcomed those European leaders, saying we have these shared values, but European societies must have the opportunity to express themselves. And he also talked about, at his core, his foundational principles really have been amongst the Christian faith leading his decision-making within the administration. You know, he was quoted as saying he wants to bring about the kind of society where his children and children across the United States can become virtuous adults.
And conservatives, what are the key priorities under this new administration?
In a short explanation, everything. J.D. Vance really touched on a variety of those domestic issues, prioritizing cheaper energy, cheaper food, less government waste with the help of DOGE, promoting a pro-life agenda. We remember with the overturning of the Roe v. Wade precedent and giving the power to determine pregnancy back to the American people, as he put it, internationally, being a quote, administration of peace, ending the conflict between Israel and Hamas, ending the war in Ukraine, realigning U.S. military interests, particularly in Europe, but really abroad as a whole, and stopping what he said is the subsidization of other countries for aid, and really doing all of this in very, very quickly. You know, he's ambitiously set really the first 100 days kind of as that ambitious marker, but really, as the commentators put it so far as he was speaking, really in the first 30 days, we're already starting to see, or the American people are starting to see already a difference in the way that the Trump administration is handling things. So the speech has only gone on for about 45 minutes, but it certainly gave a really big insight into the variety of topics that really struck a number of attendees with standing ovations from about hundreds of people here.
VOA's Anthony Labruto covering the annual CPAC conference in Washington, D.C. Thank you for your input.
Absolutely. Thank you, Harris.
The acting U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Dorothy Shea, told the U.N. Security Council that Washington is calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo.
The United States strongly condemns the seizure of Kavumu Airport and the city of Bukavu by M23 and Rwandan forces. We continue to stand in full support of the Congolese people and of their country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Once again, we urge M23 to immediately cease its offensive and withdraw from all territories of which it has taken control.
In addition, Shea said the U.S. urges Rwanda to stop its support for M23, withdraw its forces from the DRC, and hold accountable those who perpetrate human rights abuses and violations. Shea said it is beyond time for the U.N. and the international community to send a strong response to M23 and Rwandan actions. She also said the U.S. is prepared to work with the Security Council on sanctions on the combatants. The Rwandan ambassador to the U.N., Ernest Ruamosio, told the Security Council has ignored incursions by anti-Rwanda forces into its territory, and he said Rwanda should not be blamed for the DRC's problems.
Rwanda cannot take the blame for the problems that DRC has faced endemically. As President Kagame stated in Addis Ababa, and I quote, "We have our own problems to deal with. Congo is too big for Rwanda to carry on its back," end of quote. Rwanda has no interest in DRC's internal struggles.
The United States has previously threatened sanctions on Rwanda for its support for the M23 in the DRC. However, the Rwandan government denies actively backing the M23, but says its troops have acted to protect its borders and sovereignty. Rwanda also accuses the DRC of sheltering a militant group that aims to oust the Kigali government.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
A consultative body in Niger today proposed a 5-year timeline for the transition to civilian rule and the possibility of the country's military leaders standing for election. In a ceremony broadcast on state television, the head of the military government, General Abdurrahman Tayani, described it as a fresh start that brought hope for the West African nation. The military government set up a national convention to draft a new charter outlining the term of the transition after Tiani ousted democratically elected President Mohamed Bazoum in a 2023 coup. The French news agency AFP reports the convention took place from February 15th to 19th and included 716 civilian and military participants. In addition to setting out a timeline for a return to a democratic government, the consultative body said political parties would be dissolved with a new charter allowing for 2 to 5 political parties. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehaya Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.